Welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill Redway and this is the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday 18th of May 2019. The music you just heard is a track called Emma by leading young guitarist Will McNichol and percussionist Luke Selby. They've been wowing audiences at major venues like London's King's Place for several years now, so it's quite an honour that they've allowed us to use this piece on our programme. So special thanks to Will and Luke. As usual, I'll play the track in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser, and we follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days, courtesy of Sue once again. In part two, we have an article from Hearts Life magazine, beautifully read by Anne, about Humphrey Repton, the great 18th century landscape designer, whose mission it was to enrich the general face of the country. And part three is an interview with Tom Hammond, musical director of St Albans Symphony and the Hertfordshire Music Festival, which takes place in June. After which we have a special announcement from charity support service InfoSound about accessible voting for vision-impaired people in the forthcoming European parliamentary elections. We start with the news, and our readers today are Hilary, Caroline, Sarah, and Karen.
Hello there, it's Hilary here. And my first article is titled Airport Noise Campaigners Slam Unjust Growth. Various groups, including LADACAN, which is the Luton and District Association for the Control of Aircraft Noise, Harpenden Sky, STAX, which is the St Albans Quieter Skies, STAND, St Albans Aircraft Noise Defence, and the SLFFL, Stop Low Flights from Luton, have criticised the airport for prioritising its expansion over lessening the impact of aircraft noise. According to campaigners, the airport has applied to its owners, Luton Borough Council, for permission to ignore a key noise planning condition designed to control its overall noise footprint, claiming that unexpectedly quick expansion has overtaken noise mitigation. Andrew Lamborn, speaking on behalf of LADACAN, said, "People locally are utterly fed up with the ever-growing impact of Luton aircraft noise on their lives. Planning conditions were set by Luton Council in December 2013 to regulate the expansion, yet the airport seems to think it can just apply for them to be set aside whenever it wishes. This demonstrates a fundamental contempt for the planning system, which is supposed to achieve a balance between corporate benefit and protection for people on the ground. Campaigners argue that noise has increased over St Albans District since the introduction of the RNAV navigation system in 2015, which narrowed flight paths and concentrated noise over a smaller area. They have also questioned the airport's claim that an estimated 1 decibel increase in noise levels will not have a substantial impact on the surrounding environment." Noise expert Paul Flatt said, "The fact that they are trying to pull the wool over our eyes by sleight of hand in this variation request speaks eloquently of their total lack of respect for the community. Breaching a noise contour limit by that amount means you're flying a lot more noisier planes than you're supposed to. The limit was set for a reason. They need to respect it." Despite the concerns of campaigners, Luton Airport saw a 46% drop in noise complaints in 2018, with 8,275 complaints in total, compared to 15,384 in 2017. There were 691 complainants, and 68% of all complaints were made by the same 10 individuals. Luton Airport Operations Director Neil Thompson said, "London Luton Airport already operates with some of the most stringent noise control measures of any major UK airport, which includes a limit on the number of night flights and a ban on the noisiest types of aircraft. We fully comply with all of these conditions, with the exception of our noise footprint measurement, which was based on forecasts made in 2012, predicting a slower rate of passenger growth, along with the quicker introduction of the newest types of quieter aircraft. Therefore, we are seeking a temporary variation of this one condition to allow us to operate at current levels. Technical experts have estimated that there will be no more than 1 decibel increase in current noise levels, and as part of our mitigation plans, we will double the funding of our noise insulation scheme. There is a risk, without this temporary change, that the airport's significant economic contribution would be affected and would even lead to a loss of jobs. The temporary variation is expected to last until 2024. In the meantime, the other existing noise control measures will remain in place." A Luton Borough Council spokesman said, "The council has received an application from the operator of London Luton Airport to temporarily vary condition 10 relating to the airport's consented growth to 18 million passengers per year, approved in 2014. The council's role as local planning authority is entirely separate to that as shareholder of London Luton Airport Limited. Each is run wholly independent of each other, with their respective functions entirely separate. The application will be subject to statutory consultation undertaken by the council as the local planning authority and dealt with impartially, fairly and transparently. A decision will be reached based on all material planning considerations and sound judgments supported by clear planning reasons."
Hello, I'm Caroline. A popular specialist market has been forced to cancel after it was accidentally double-booked with another event. Since October last year, the St Albans Antique and Vintage Market has brought a variety of specialist traders to St Peter's Street every month. Proving to be immediately popular, founder Jenny Titmus booked and confirmed the 2019 dates in writing with the St Albans District Council last year. She printed the schedule on thousands of promotional leaflets, which had been distributed around the district. Jenny was therefore shocked to see the St Albans Sustainability Festival Market takeover advertised for one of her dates, May the 19th. Confirming the mix-up with SADC, Jenny was told she must cancel her event. She said, "I have accepted it now because I have to, but when I saw it I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? I have printed thousands of leaflets and there will be lots of disappointed people turning up to the sustainability market. I've told people on the website and Facebook, but what else can I do? There are thousands of people that I can't possibly reach because I don't know who they are." She was offered the chance to move the date, but Jenny refused to avoid complicating it further. Jenny said, "I do feel it reflects really badly on me. I don't want to badmouth the council, but I have to say it is the council's fault." The market takeover is one of numerous events running as part of the St Albans Sustainability Festival 2019, between May the 11th to June the 1st. Chair of the Sustainability Festival Organising Group, Catherine Ross, said, "We were just so relieved when we heard that the market takeover could still go ahead, since over 80 local charities and businesses are involved, and it's the central event of the Sustainability Festival 2019. She said they would have happily included vintage fashion stalls in the market takeover, but it didn't prove possible. Head of the Community Services at SADC, Joe Tavernier, said, "We've apologised to the vintage market for the cancellation, which was the result of a human error. We discovered a sustainability festival event had already been booked in for the same date and took action as soon as this was realised." He said measures have been taken to avoid this happening again, adding that SADC is pleased the event will return in June.
Hello, my name is Karen and I'm reading an article about lasting legacies for Rennie Grove. Sue Marvel, recently retired director of nursing at Rennie Grove Hospice Care, explains why she has left a gift to the charity in her will. "Do you find there are times in life when you pause to reflect on what matters most? I've done that myself recently, as I've been preparing to leave Rennie Grove after 31 years. Looking back, I know I've made a difference to patients and their families, and I wonder, have you thought about the difference you've made? I joined Rennie Grove in 1988, and I've seen much change since then. Compassionate, professional care, available day and night, remains at the heart of what the charity does. And with treatment and equipment getting better and better, services evolve all the time. There are issues to be faced, though. The side effects of extended treatment mean that by the end of life, the care people need can be very complicated. We know the population is getting older, so in the next 20 years, more people than ever will need end-of-life care. With the pressures on the NHS and a national shortage of nurses, providing the service in the future will be a challenge. That's where Rennie Grove's generous supporters come in, people who care and want to help the local community. Many supporters decide that they can help by leaving a gift in their will. Is this something you could consider? 1 in 3 of Rennie Grove's nurses is currently funded by gifts in wills. I've pledged a gift in my will because I want to make sure this service is here for my children and grandchildren. I'm not wealthy, but I want to support more families with what I leave behind. A gift to Rennie Grove will prepare the charity for the challenges ahead. The 24/7 care its nurses provide means the world to ordinary families. The support they received, delivered when it mattered most, is made possible through the generosity of people like you. So please consider supporting Rennie Grove in this way. If there's anything you'd like to ask our friendly Gifts in Wills team, please get in touch on 01442 507 344 or legacy@renniegrove.org.
Hello, I'm Sarah, and the next article is entitled Can You Get to See Your GP? Headlines around the country have been dominated this week by news that the number of GPs is in decline for the first time since the 1960s. The Nuffield Trust think tank found that there were 65 GPs per 100,000 people in 2014, but last year this fell to 60. In light of the news, chair of the Maltings Surgery Patient Group, Alan Bellinger, analysed statistics that he gained from his participation in a PBG Insight project to narrow down the local numbers as of January 2019. He found the number of GPs per 10,000 residents sat at a national average of 5.5. The local situation is varied. Hatfield Road Surgery has 4.8. The Lattimore and Village Surgery has 4.9. Parkbury House Surgery has 5.2. Grange Street Surgery has 5.9. The Maltings Surgery has 6.1. Havery Group Practice has 6.8. And Midway Surgery has 7. Alan said that the figures take into account if the GP is full-time or part-time, but warned that they're extrapolated out of a large set of data. For example, Hatfield Road employ 2 GPs for just over 4,200 patients. They also do not take into account maternity leave, sickness, and the size of practices. He said, in comparison with the average, overall St Albans comes out pretty well. It's well above England's average and it's above the Harts Valley's CCG average, so that bodes well. But there is a big variation between the surgeries when you dig into it. With most of the surgeries in St Albans, you'll have problems getting appointments. But the concept of a patient being able to pick up a healthcare professional and see whoever they want is a bit archaic, because we're not the best judge of who we should see. He said a new triage system is becoming more prolific. This is where a patient is initially assessed by a nurse over the phone to refer or advise them. St Albans' mum, Hilary Childs, said that she had to wait 5 weeks for an appointment at the Maltings Surgery. She'd been with the practice for more than 20 years, but after the experience, decided to register elsewhere. I was really upset about that. I didn't know if my problem was desperate or not. I'm not a doctor, so how do I know if it's life-threatening or if I'm not well? If I'm feeling down or under the weather, it could be anything. Hilary stressed she is not a hypochondriac who wastes appointment time. If I want to go to the doctor, it's because there's something genuinely wrong and I will be anxious about it. Practice manager at the Maltings Surgery, Susan Trounce, said they welcome all feedback. She said, the malting surgery deals with any issue that's medically urgent on the same day, but appointments to fit around a person's own schedule or with a particular clinician can mean a wait. As you can see, we are not under-resourced, but occasionally demand on our staff and services can be very high. She said there will be a new appointment system introduced in June, which will improve access radically. Practice manager at Hatfield Road Surgery, Babita Sina, stressed her GPs work more than normal full-time hours. She said, "We are recruiting for female GPs at the moment, but because of the shortage, we're not able to find anyone. There is a shortage of GPs nationwide because so many doctors are only interested in locum work. Locum doctors work on a short-term contract." Chair of the Royal College of GPs, Professor Helen Stokes Lampard, also addressed the shortage. She is optimistic about the future, but found that national figures were disheartening. "There is some excellent work ongoing to boost the recruitment into general practices, and as a result, we have more GPs in training than ever before. But GPs cannot be trained overnight, and whilst we wait for the next generation of family doctors to enter the workforce, existing GPs and our teams are struggling to manage escalating workloads without enough time or resources to deal with them." A spokeswoman from the Harts Valley Clinical Commissioning Group said they could not corroborate Alan's figures. Official and accurate figures are reported by individual GP practices to NHS Digital and published on their website. As part of the NHS long-term plan, we are committed to recruiting GPs locally through retention, return to practice, and an internal recruitment programme. She said there is a scheme to support GPs who might otherwise leave.
A man who allowed his van to be used by fly tippers has been fined nearly £700 by St Albans District Council. Yannet Damien, 30, of Lawn Lane, Hemel Hempstead, pleaded guilty to the offence under the Environmental Protection Act after letting his van be used for the illegal transportation and fly tipping of rubbish in Hog End Lane near St Albans. In a written statement to St Albans Magistrate Court, Damien said that he had been paid £40 by two men to use his Volkswagen transporter. He said the men told him they wanted to pick some items up from Chelsea. Damien said that the vehicle was then used without his knowledge to take and dump two electric heaters and some wood by the roadside, adding, "I deny being present at the scene or disposing of waste myself." CCTV footage captured the van and a BMW car parking in the fly-tipping hotspot on September the 16th, 2017. In the footage, one man appeared to act as a lookout, while two other men fly-tipped the rubbish onto the verge. Council officers found the van was a rental vehicle and traced it back to Damien, who was in control of it at the time. He was interviewed under caution and initially refused to identify the people involved in the fly-tip. He later revealed the name of one man he had loaned the van to, but by that time the man had moved to Romania. Damien was fined £100 at the hearing on Wednesday, May the 1st, and ordered to pay the council £407 in compensation for waste removal costs and a £30 victim surcharge. He was also ordered to make a contribution to prosecution costs of £150, bringing the total sum to £687. The council's head of community services, Joe Tavernier, said, "This is the third successful prosecution for a fly-tipping offence that we have brought this year. It demonstrates our determination to deter fly-tipping by tracing those responsible and taking action against them. It also shows that the measures we are taking to combat this antisocial crime, such as the use of cameras in hotspots, are effective. In this case, the person taken to court did not carry out the fly-tip themselves. It's a reminder to people that they have a legal responsibility to ensure that waste is only picked up for disposal by someone who is licensed to do so."
A 96-year-old St Albans man was reunited with the Belle from the Royal Navy ship he served with in World War II. Frank Whitten, who lives on Ashley Road, boarded wartime destroyer HMS Wollaston when she was sent to Bergen in May 1945 to accept the surrender of the German naval forces. His son Alan, who lives in North Carolina, discovered the bell from HMS Wollaston was on sale on eBay from an auction house in Portsmouth and wanted to get it for his father as a gift. The bell was sold to someone else living 200 miles away, so Alan got in touch, drove to the new owner's house and haggled for the bell, eventually agreeing to pay a premium on the original price. He then visited St Albans and gave the bell to Frank in time for the anniversary of the liberation of Bergen on May the 15th. Alan said, "The feeling of disbelief and excitement in being able to find this for my dad was unbelievable." Flying over from the USA with the ship's bell in a handbag had its own challenges. As you can imagine, 36 pounds of bronze bell going through an X-ray machine at the airport had everyone running in my direction. Family friend Bill Forster, who lives on Hollywell Hill and is a member of the V&W Destroyer Association, got to know Frank and Alan after writing a book on the ship his father, Lieutenant William Forster, served on, the HMS Venomous. He said Frank is absolutely delighted. It's got the name of the ship and the date 1918 on it. Frank was able to tell me where it used to hang on the ship. I've known Frank for a long time. He astonished me by producing a small aluminium box, beautifully engraved. It was given to him by a Russian prisoner of war who came aboard his ship at Bergen and gave it to him in exchange for a new penknife. Frank, who lives with his wife Kath, was born in St Albans on December the 16th, 1922. His father worked as a coachman for the retired judge, who paid for Frank to attend a school run by two spinster sisters in Hollywell Hill. After disembarking from HMS Wollaston, he joined HMS Suffolk and was sent to Melbourne in Australia. He left the Navy in 1946, married and lived in Edinburgh for a few months before returning to St Albans, where he worked as a boilerman at Rose's Lime Juice in Grosvenor Road for 35 years.
A petition urging St Albans to take drastic action against global warming has been created by eco-friendly groups as part of the Sustainability Festival 2019. Festival charity organiser Sustainable St Albans, together with St Albans Friends of the Earth, are asking the public support in demanding St Albans District Council declare a climate emergency. The group say once this has happened, the district can work towards becoming carbon neutral by 2030. It says, "People expect an emergency announcement when there is a life-threatening situation and will hesitate to take any action themselves if nobody else appears to be taking the threat seriously. Think of a fire alarm. People might initially think it is just a drill and will ignore it if someone else does. But as soon as someone who is considered to be a leader says the fire is indeed real and points out the safest exit to use, everyone will drop what they are doing and evacuate. So declaring a climate emergency is a vital first step. It will empower our community, encourage others to follow suit, and help all of us treat the climate crisis as the existential emergency that it is." It lists other authorities which have taken this step, including Bedford Borough Council, Devon County Council, City of York Council, Oxford City Council and Milton Keynes Council. A recent United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, report said humanity has a little over a decade to reverse global warming before it cannot stop the floods, droughts, extreme heat and poverty. Trustee of Sustainable St Albans, Catherine Ross, said, "Responding to this climate emergency, which will affect us and our children for generations to come, is a non-party political issue. It requires cooperation and collaboration across party lines." Dozens of councils around the country have already declared climate emergencies, as have MPs in the UK Parliament and the Welsh Assembly. We want our St Albans District Council to play its part too. More than 200 people have already signed the petition. If it reaches 500 supporters, it will be debated at the St Albans District Council full council meeting. St Albans resident Anna Hardist said, "I hope local sixth formers and students all sign. The petition calls for carbon neutrality by 2030, ambitious but not out of reach. Everyone who signs it is calling on the St Albans Council to act and use their power to make decisions that will benefit us and all those that follow." The 20-year-old studies physics at the University of Warwick. Anna added, "It is time to do what the generations before us failed to do, create a sustainable future for our world." According to its greenhouse gas emissions report, St Albans District Council reduced its overall emissions by 19% between 2008 and 2018. By signing the Nottingham Declaration on Climate Change in 2006, St Albans District Council committed to reducing emissions by 3% every year and aimed to achieve a 60% reduction by 2025. Portfolio holder for the environment at St Albans District Council, Francis Leonard, was contacted for comment. To view and sign the petition, visit sustainablestalbans.org/petition. This comes as part of the St Albans Sustainability Festival 2019, which runs from May the 11th to June the 1st. Events are taking place all over the district, including St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding villages. Find out more about all the events making up the Sustainability Festival and download a schedule by visiting sustainablestalbans.org/get-started/sust-festival. Many events are free, but some require booking. See the programme for details.
The next article is Nature Notes, Rupert Evershed's monthly diary of the natural world. It might just be me, but sometimes I feel as if I've seen too much nature, too much wildlife, too many amazing wonders of the natural world. When I say this, I'm not talking about the nature I've experienced firsthand, the nature I've actually heard, seen, smelt, touched, and yes, even tasted. I'm talking about the images of nature seen during hours of exquisite wildlife documentaries, within the glossy pages of premium wildlife magazines, and countless other exceptional photos, capturing creatures at their most lovely, their most beautiful, and dazzling us with their finery and finesse. The message is clear. Nature is extraordinary, beautiful in the extreme, complex at times, perplexing, but always surprising and infinite. But it is this word extraordinary that bothers me. It's the subtle message of all these fine productions that nature is extraordinary, outside and beyond our ordinary, everyday lives. And what's worse is, the more I watch, the more ordinary this extraordinary becomes. The once exotic unknown has been revealed up close and personal again and again, thanks to our camera technology. It's as if the bride has bared all, leaving no surprises or mystery for her wedding night. And yet, in reality, nature makes us wait, makes us go on a journey of discovery, allowing us only glimpses at a time. It's this process of persevering, of waiting, of uncovering, that makes wildlife watching so rewarding and ultimately deeply personal. Of course I'm not against the incredible wildlife programmes we enjoy on TV. They serve an important purpose. But what we see is served on a plate that we never had to wait or work for. It's a meal consumed for which we were never hungry. Almost 2 years ago to the day, I wrote about the closure of Butterfly World in St Albans. At the time, there was a thin thread of hope that it might reopen as Butterfly World 2. But years on, this is not to be. It appears Butterfly World was a meal for which we were not hungry, at least not enough to see through some of the rocky financial times. The closure was a sad moment, for it was hoped it would be an oasis for butterflies, and in its short lifespan, it had already become just that for the small blue butterfly. Absent from hearts for nearly 5 years, this little butterfly is now enjoying not one, but two broods in a season, thanks to the ideal habitat created at Butterfly World. But I can't help wondering that had Butterfly World gone ahead in all its glory, it might have served us up a feast that dulled us to the nature around us. I suggest that the story of Butterfly World provided a good illustration of the journey we must all go on when it comes to conserving and enjoying our natural world. I said there must be a grassroots movement, one that's ownership of the local community, expressing its own care for its own local nature. It was therefore exciting to meet Malcolm Hull, chairman of the Hearts and Middlesex Butterfly Conservation at Greenwood Park in St Albans, where this has been happening. With the support of St Stephen Parish Council and funding from a lottery heritage fund, a purpose-built chalk bank has been dug out and is being seeded and planted with chalk-loving plants, and it's hoped it will provide the perfect habitat for butterflies. A particular target species is the small blue butterfly that will hopefully colonise the area, cleverly designed to provide warmer microclimates and planted with a small blue's favourite food, kidney vetch. While this is a relatively small-scale project, it's pulled together local volunteers and organisations, including the local primary school. It's a truly grassroots project that could be replicated across Hertfordshire, even on a miniature scale, in our own gardens. Butterfly World may be closed, but it lives on in our community action like this, and I was equally heartened. To get inspired by the project at Greenwood Park, go along to the public launch at 10:30 on Sunday, May the 26th, at the Greenwood Park Community Centre.
There are some dramatic before and after pictures with this next article, showing a St Albans mum who managed to shed 6 stone in a year. Anne Rogers had been overweight for as long as she could remember and fluctuated around 20 stone since 2009. In the past, Anne had managed to temporarily lose weight with the help of fitness programmes such as the NHS Couch to 5K, but she always bounced back up sooner or later. Following her second pregnancy in summer 2017, Anne joined the gym at Westminster Lodge Leisure Centre and started to seriously slim down. With the help of small group training instructor and personal trainer Wendy Martin, Anne is now 8 stone lighter than her heaviest and 6 stone less than she was when she signed up. Anne said, "Small group training is definitely one of my favourite types of training. I love everyone's enthusiasm when you work out as a group. You form friendships with the other members and working out together pushes you to achieve more, having more fun than if you're on your own. We even have a group chat in WhatsApp to keep us driven during the week, sharing recipes or tips and getting homework from Wendy. It has definitely been instrumental in keeping me motivated to keep on my weight loss journey." Anne has recently been awarded Member of the Month by the Westminster Lodge team. She said, "My weight loss journey definitely isn't finished. I still have a couple of stone that I want to lose to get me to a mid-range healthy body mass index for my height, and it is definitely a bit more of a battle sometimes. I'm incredibly proud of what I've achieved so far and grateful to the Westminster Lodge team, who have all been influential in helping to change my life and get me to where I want to be. Westminster Lodge is run by Everyone Active in partnership with St Albans District Council. Everyone Active fitness manager Will Brentnell said, "We love watching our members succeed in their fitness ventures and are particularly proud of Anne's weight loss achievements. She always comes into the gym with a smile on her face, ready to work hard, and the results she has seen are a testament to her determination."
Train stations across Hertfordshire will receive £80,000 in compensation after being deemed some of the worst affected by the timetable debacle. The introduction of the new Govia Thameslink railway timetable last May created chaos for commuters who battled with daily cancellations, delays and overcrowding. GTR is now asking passengers and stakeholders to suggest how a £15 million pot of money should be invested to help compensate people using the stations, including Harpenden, Radlett and St Albans City. Creator of the Facebook St Albans Commuter and Passenger Action Group and prospective parliamentary candidate Daisy Cooper said, "This is long overdue. Nonetheless, this investment is welcome, and I look forward to facilitating what I hope will be a genuine consultation by Thameslink with St Albans commuters and passengers." She said this has come after lobbying from commuter groups across the country. Emily Ketchin spoke on behalf of the Harpenden Thameslink Commuters Group. "Whilst any effort to make improvements has to be welcome, this £80,000 in no way makes up for the fact that Thameslink slashed key Harpenden services by one third in the May 2018 timetable. Not only have they failed for the last 12 months even to run all the trains they promised, they still have no plans to deliver even that full service. Harpenden commuters need a return to the fast, frequent service which we had until last May." She said, "Thameslink gimmicks do not make up for the extra time Harpenden commuters wait on platform while the Bedford Express misses the town station," adding, Put simply, the £80,000 will not bring back the service that we were promised and are paying for. That is where the focus needs to be. Govia's Deputy Chief Operating Officer, Alex Fould, said, "This is a fantastic opportunity for us to work closely with our customers and make meaningful improvements that will benefit passengers across our network. Over the next 3 months, we'll be asking passenger groups to tell us the improvements they think we should make through a new website and survey. We're also asking passengers to join our passenger panel to tell us how we can invest the money," he added.
A campaign to avert a national water crisis is underway outside St Albans Cathedral. Affinity Water has created its hashtag Why Not Water campaign in anticipation of a Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, announcement to consult on lowering the national water usage target by 2050. Water in the South East is in particular crisis because there is less rainfall over this region and population growth could mean severe shortages in the next 25 years. The campaign calls on the population to demand key energy and water-saving legislative changes. The large ice installation at the St Albans launch represents 8,000 litres of water, the average family of four uses in 2 weeks. It is all part of the St Albans Sustainability Festival 2019. Jake Rigg, Director of Communications, Communities and Corporate Affairs at Affinity Water, said, "We must act now to avert a crisis. We need to increase the supply of water through new options and by moving water between areas and by reducing demand. The most effective way of doing this is by introducing a mandatory water efficiency labelling scheme, and without it we will have a crisis on our hands. The hashtag Why Not Water manifesto asks the government to introduce obligatory water efficiency labels so buyers can make informed choices, give tenants more rights to water-saving products in rented accommodation, and ensure fixtures and fittings meet minimum standards." He added, "We need to work in collaboration with government, the water companies and civil society, but with fierce urgency. This is why we have launched this campaign. Consumers are used to energy labelling in Britain and manufacturers have responded by reducing the energy consumption of white goods. We have this for energy, why not water? All we are asking for is a common sense approach to water. Find out more about the campaign at www.whynotwater.co.uk. Affinity Water has also created a petition urging the government to take more action. View it at www.affinitywater.co.uk/ourpetition.
And now for a couple of local news articles from Harpenden. A European politician visited some of her spikier constituents in Harpenden to raise awareness of plummeting hedgehog numbers. Hertfordshire MEP Alex Mayer went to Hornbean Wood Hedgehog Sanctuary on Common Lane in Harpenden as part of a push to save the iconic creatures. According to the State of Britain's Hedgehogs report, the animals have declined by a third since 2000. MEP Alex said, "Hedgehogs are in a bit of a prickle at the moment, but it's great to find out hog lovers everywhere can do their bit to help out our prickly friends." Martin Malin founded Batford's Hornbeam Wood Hedgehog Sanctuary in 2015 on the site of a former animal sanctuary called the Graham Dangerfield Wildlife Trust. MEP Alex visited the charity to find out how the charity helps sick, injured and underweight hedgehogs, learning how to make gardens safe spaces for the animals. Find out more at www.hornbeamwood.org.uk. A primary school PTA was awarded a grant to create inspiring learning spaces from Harpenden Trust Community Fund. The Lee Primary and Nursery School in Moorland Road in Harpenden will use the grant to contribute towards a PTA-funded project to improve pupil well-being. Steve Pryor of the Harpenden Trust visited the school on Friday, April the 26th to present the cheque and see the work so far. The money has already been used to transform an underused room at the school into a light, airy classroom with purpose-built storage, and there are plans to create colourful playground markings for the children. PTA Vice Chair Katie Hamilton said, We're delighted to have been chosen to receive a community fund grant, and we know that the money will have a real impact on our children's learning and enjoyment of school. The Community Fund offers grants to local voluntary organisations and community groups, particularly those linked to youth, education and the elderly, for specific projects. Head teacher James Berry said, "I'm delighted for our children that the grant's been awarded. It has enabled us to make better use of existing areas of the school as high-quality learning environments, which is of great benefit to the children."
Reality TV, virtual reality, and the Jacobean thirst for sex, bloodshed and intrigue are blended together in OVO's forthcoming production of The Changeling at the Maltings Arts Theatre. OVO's update of this gripping and darkly comic classic takes us to the disturbing and dysfunctional heart of celebrity and privilege. The Changeling can be seen at the Maltings Arts Theatre in St Albans until Saturday, May the 18th, and then again from Thursday, May the 23rd to Saturday, May the 25th. The classic play has been brought firmly into the 21st century by setting it in a celebrity rehab clinic, which is part of a bizarre live TV experiment. The cast mix theatrical action with live TV, and even a virtual reality sequence, specially designed by local company Vertronics. "We're trying things here that are very different, daring and exciting," said David Bevan, the show's director. "It's going to be a real event that will definitely surprise, perhaps shock, and hopefully move our audience. I've got a fabulous cast of talented actors from all over the Southeast who have been drawn to St Albans by the play, the concept, and the unique acting challenges it poses. Rehearsals have been intense and wonderfully committed. I can't wait to see the final result." The show tells the story of Beatrice Joanna's fatal fall from grace as she conspires with her hated manservant to murder her fiancé and maidservant. It's a complicated but thrilling story that moves at exhilarating speed, and due to some of its content, is probably suited to secondary school age upwards, said Bevan. "I urge you to see it. Love it or hate it, you certainly won't forget it." Tickets are available online from Ticketsource or on the door.
Even amateur drama can be affected by Brexit, it seems. Wheathamsted's Dramatic Society's production of The Herd, featuring Julie Gough, Robert Langer and Jan Westgarth, will open next Wednesday instead of Thursday, May the 23rd. The Society discovered that the Memorial Hall is to be used as a polling station for the EU elections on what should have been their opening night, Thursday, May the 23rd, and so have to bring forward their first night by a day. Director Malcolm Hobbs said, "We had to have two versions of the publicity material ready, each with a different date for the opening night, until it became clear that the elections were going ahead." The Society's latest production comes from the award-winning actor Rory Kinnear, one of the finest stage actors of his generation, and increasingly to be seen also on the large and small screen. He has drawn on his own family's experiences of living with a disabled older sister to create a heartfelt but often very funny play about a mother's trials and tribulations as she attempts to prepare for her severely disabled son's 21st birthday. Tickets cost £10 from the Manor Pharmacy in High Street and online at www.wheathamsteddramaticsociety.co.uk or by calling 01582 621 357.
A group which was initially founded to save St Albans Butterfly World is hosting an evening of bee-themed entertainment in St Albans. Butterfly World 2 was set up as Save Butterfly World, with the aim of saving the Chiswell Green project after it closed down in 2016. The group now continues Butterfly World's legacy and has sown wildflower meadows in St Albans Abbey Orchard, Watford and Hemel Hempstead. A folk concert hosted by the charity will be held at the Rose and Crown pub in St Michael's Street from 8pm till 10pm on Thursday, May the 30th, as part of St Albans Sustainability Festival. The concert will feature music from Song Hive, a folk song project which aims to raise awareness of the plight of bees. founder Rowan Piggott and his band will perform a mixture of songs in praise of bees. Doors open at 7:30 and donations will be divided between Butterfly World 2 and Friends of the Earth. A well-known St Albans broadcaster appeared on national radio to spread the word about his local podcast. Danny Smith was asked to join presenter Simon Mayo on Scala Radio to talk about the St Albans podcast, which launched last month in conjunction with the Hearts ad. It is a weekly podcast focused on delivering news and insights for and about the local area. Danny was named Captain Scala for April the 24th, a puny title acknowledging one hard worker each day. He said, "I have been involved in local voluntary broadcasting for quite a long time, but I really felt there was a gap in St Albans and felt we needed to do something to give local organisations, non-profit groups, charities and things like that a chance to be able to tell everyone about what they do." Danny added how amazed he was at the number of local charitable groups in a relatively small city like St Albans. Catch up at www.stalbanspodcast.com.
Free lunchtime recital. There will be a recital by Joanna Reveley on the flute and Simon Gilliver on piano at St Peter's Church on Wednesday, May 22nd at 1 p.m. Joanna was a member of the National Youth Wind Orchestra and Bedfordshire Youth Orchestra in her teens. Although she graduated in social anthropology from Newnham College in Cambridge, she was always passionate about the flute. She went on to be a woodwind teacher for the Bedfordshire Music Service, specialising in the flute for some 7 years. As well as performing, Joanna teaches the flute at Haberdashers Asks Boys' School in Elstree and Kingshot School in Hitchin. Simon enjoyed a widely varied career as a flautist, pianist and teacher. He has a wealth of experience accompanying all instruments and singers, perhaps, unsurprisingly, spends much of his time accompanying flautists.
And now some radio listings. From Saturday the 18th of May to Friday the 24th of May. On Saturday the 18th of May, Clive Anderson and Emma Freud are joined by guests from the theatrical and film industries to discuss their current projects in Loose Ends on Radio 4 at 6:15 p.m, repeated on Monday at 11:30 a.m. On Radio 3 at 6:30 p.m, Opera on 3 presents Ian Bell's most recent opera, Jack the Ripper, The Women of Whitechapel, which, despite its chilling title, focuses on the backstories of the unfortunate ladies who met their death at his hands, and the assailant himself never appears. Performed by the ENO at the London Coliseum, and including some of the best-known female voices of the company. Ken Bruce presents the 64th Annual Eurovision Song Contest from Tel Aviv in Israel on Radio 2 at 8 p.m. The UK hopes rest with Michael Rice, who performs the song Bigger Than Us. Over on Radio 4 at 8 p.m, Archive on 4 is presented by former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who was one of the first tutors for the Open University. And as it celebrates its 50th year, he looks at how the OU came about, its success and current challenges, and its future. And now for Sunday the 19th of May. Commentary on the fifth and final one-day international test match between England and Pakistan, which takes place at Headingley in Leeds, begins at 10:45 a.m. through to 7 p.m. on Radio 4 Longwave and also on 5 Live Sports Extra on digital only. At 11:15 a.m. on Radio 4 FM, Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs is makeup artist Pat McGrath, who has worked with designers including Alexander McQueen and John Galliano. This is repeated on Friday at 9 a.m. On Radio 3 at 6:45 p.m, Sunday feature is Alexander Korda, producer, director, exile, spy. Matthew Sweet unearths Korda's wartime role as a British agent. Phil Wang, Wang-splaining, is the intriguing title of a pilot episode on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. and is one of today's critical choices. Phil Wang, having been born in Britain but whose family returned to his father's Malay Peninsula homeland, offers a very funny and intelligent exploration of the good and bad that came out of the British Empire.
A look now at programmes that ran on each day through the week from Monday. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 on Radio 4 is Gudrun. Also repeated at 7:45pm, this is the first of 10 episodes in the return of the Lucy Catherine's drama, inspired by Icelandic sagas. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at midday is Dmitri Shostakovich, 1906 to 1975. Radio 3 other concert programmes are as usual at 1pm, 2pm and in concert at 7:30pm, but with a classic FM full works concert at 8pm. There is too much material to list here, but hopefully there will be something for everyone. At 1:45pm on Radio 4, in the first of 10 episodes, 50 More Things That Made the Modern Economy explores inventions and developments that the modern economy could not have been the same without. The 2:15pm drama on Radio 4 is Keeping the Wolf Out. This crime drama by Philip Palmer is set in communist Hungary in 1963. Special investigator Bertalan Lazar tries to solve the crime. At 10:45pm on Radio 3, the essay is True Venetian. Polly Coles reads her essays in search of what makes a true Venetian. Beginning each one with an object or place, she traces a cultural and historical thread through to living individuals who are contributing to a rich and diverse contemporary Venetian culture.
And some picks for each day from Monday to Friday. For Monday the 20th of May, Andrew Marr starts the week at 9am on Radio 4 with Joshua Mesrich, a leading transport surgeon who discusses the extraordinary breakthroughs that have emerged in his field, and also the ethical questions that arise from having to choose who will have the chance of a new beginning. On the World Service at 11:30am and repeated at 10:30pm, The Conversation talks to two 76-year-old women who have been leaders in their fields on how to live life to the full, whatever your age. Jazz Now on Radio 3 at 11pm showcases saxophonist Rachel Musson and her nine-piece band, recorded in May from the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, and also featuring saxophonist Kosha Cole, the BBC Young Jazz Musician of the Year. For Tuesday the 21st of May, in the first of a new series of Reith lectures, Law's Expanding Empire, on Radio 4 at 9am, Jonathan Sumption, until recently a Justice of the UK Supreme Court and a distinguished historian, argues that the law is taking over the space once occupied by politics. At 11am on Radio 4 in Pick Up Your Stretcher and Walk, Damon Rose, a blind journalist, approaches the difficulties he has faced with Christian healers and meets disabled Christians who are trying to carve out a new theology of disability. At 11:30am on Radio 4, The Art of Now features Puerto Rico, following the devastating Hurricane Maria in 2017, the programme meets some of the island's artists who stepped up to rebuild the cultural scene there. In Great Lives on Radio 4 at 4:30pm, Matthew Paris is joined by the folk singer Shirley Collins, who has nominated the folklorist and American song collector Andy Lomax, with whom she fell in love after they met at a party in 1954. Singer Billy Bragg also contributes.
For Wednesday, 22nd of May, on Radio 4 at 9am, Behind the Scenes features a profile of the British Asian filmmaker Gurinder Chadha, recorded in Jaipur, India, the setting for her new, lavish, period six-part TV series, Beecham House, due to air this summer on ITV. Her other credits include Bend It Like Beckham and Viceroy's House. At 11:30am, also on Radio 4, Suggs, Love Letters to London, is the second in a series recorded in front of live audiences in Hoxton Hall, East London. Madness frontman Graham McPherson, better known as Suggs, is joined in conversation by Paul Weller as they reminisce about Soho and also get together to perform a song. On the BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m. and 10:05 p.m, The Compass is investigating how our bodies, and particularly our spines, are changing due to more sedentary lifestyles, and how lower back pain, which results from this, is leading medical teams to study the villages of Pemja in Kenya for answers. Back to Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. and John Finnemore's Souvenir Programme is back for a new series of his sketch show. For Thursday 23rd of May, Radio 4 has a new series of From Our Own Correspondent at 11 a.m. with Kate Adie, presenting reports from across the globe as BBC correspondents examine stories in their own regions. Then at 3 p.m. in Ramblings on Radio 4, Claire Balding joins Fergal Sharkey, former singer with the band The Undertones, for a walk along the river on the South London and Surrey border. In the second part of the tribute to the late comedian Jeremy Hardy, Sandy Toksvig narrates clips of highlights from his large and varied body of work in When Jeremy Hardy Spoke to the Nation, which is at 6:30 on Radio 4. For Friday 24th of May, Dave Podmore's World Cup Triumph on Radio 4 at 11:30 a.m. is another comedy in the series written by the trio of Douglas, Nichols and Newman, and features the comic alter ego of Christopher Douglas, who returns as The Pod in the run-up to the 2019 Cricket World Cup with his classic brand of humour. And of course, Friday night is music night on Radio 2 at 8 p.m. This week, Irish soul singer Imelda May celebrates the music of greats such as Van Morrison, U2, The Cranberries and others, recorded on the 6th of May from the London Palladium.
Hello, I'm Anne, and this article is entitled Giant of the Landscape. It's written by Deborah Spring, and it's about Humphrey Repton's mission, which was to enrich the general face of the country. 2 centuries after his death, his major landscape designs, including in Hertfordshire, still captivate. Humphrey Repton began working as a landscape designer 5 years after the death of the hugely influential Lancelot Capability Brown in 1783. In his mid-30s, running short of money after dabbling unsuccessfully in occupations including textiles and farming, the son of a Suffolk excise collector finally found his vocation. His work would go on to include Woburn Abbey, Longleat, Brighton's Royal Pavilion and London's Russell Square, and his vision can still be admired today in Hertfordshire. The University of Hertfordshire Press has marked the bicentenary of Repton's death with a lavishly illustrated volume on his Hertfordshire commissions. The book is the result of several years' hard work by members of the Hertfordshire Gardens Trust Research Group. In Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth Bennet comes across Mr. Darcy and the two Bingley sisters strolling amid the shrubbery. Invited to join them, Elizabeth exclaims, "No, no, stay where you are. You are charmingly grouped and appear to uncommon advantage. The picturesque would be spoilt by admitting the fourth." When Jane Austen moves her characters outdoors into the Regency landscape, we find such gentle vignettes parodying the vogue for the picturesque. Designing a landscape as if composing a painting became fashionable towards the end of the 18th century, and Repton, himself a skilled artist, trod a fine line between the art of landscape gardening and the robust pastoral style of his predecessor, Brown. Repton was well known in Austen's world and put in a personal appearance in Mansfield Park, where the fashion for improving the landscape is addressed directly. "Cut down an avenue? What a pity," says Fanny Price, when Mr. Rushworth suggests felling the ancient oaks on his estate, Southerton. Rushworth has been inspired by a visit to a friend's house and grounds, which Repton has transformed. In comparison, he says, Southerton looks like a dismal old prison. I must try to do something with it, but I do not know what. I hope I shall have some good friend to help me. Your best friend upon such an occasion, says Miss Bertram, would be Mr. Repton, I imagine. That's what I was thinking of. I think I had better have him at once. His terms are 5 guineas a day. Plenty of Hertfordshire landowners followed Mr. Rushworth's fictional lead and called in Repton to modernise their gardens and grounds with his signature rolling parkland with pretty clumps of trees, flower gardens, terraces, conservatories and shrubberies. The new book by the Hertfordshire Gardens Trust is an extensive study of these. Using a mix of site surveys and patient detective work in libraries and archives, the Trust's team of volunteer researchers identified 19 Repton sites in Herts, more than any other county. Among Repton's Hertfordshire commissions are 8 of major importance, including Ashridge House, Haileybury College, Panshanger, and Wall Hall. The research, to establish how far Repton's ideas were realised and how much survives of them today in the county, was directed by Professor Tom Williamson of the University of East Anglia, who is the book's co-editor, alongside former Hertfordshire archivist Sue Flood. Repton is famed for the red books he produced for clients. When called upon for my opinion concerning the improvement of a place, he wrote, I have generally delivered it in writing, bound in a small book containing maps and sketches to explain the alterations proposed. This is called the red book of the place, and thus my opinions have been diffused over the kingdom in nearly 200 such manuscript volumes. Beautifully bound in red Moroccan leather, they contain Repton's watercolours of the before views of a landscape, with a hinged flap to lift to reveal the proposed after. His descriptions of features and improvements are handwritten in elegant copperplate. 6 of the original books he produced for Hertfordshire clients survive. Some are held at Hertfordshire Archives and local studies in Hertford, including the red books for Panshanger and 2 in Water, sites where Repton's work can still be seen today. When the 5th Earl Cooper engaged Repton in 1799 to improve Tew and Water and his other estates in the River Mimram Valley, Repton proposed giving each estate, quote, a degree of extent and consequence, unquote, while, quote, their united lawns will, by extending through the whole valley, enrich the general face of the country, close quotes. Repton generally relied on more subtle effects than Capability Brown. If Brown was a cosmetic surgeon, says Tom Williamson, Repton was a makeup artist. Repton's 30-year career crossed from the 18th into the 19th century, his style a bridge between the landscape parks of Brown to the more structured gardens of the Victorian period. By the end of his career, Repton was designing highly formal gardens, even geometric parterre, features that would have been anathema to Brown. One of his most significant late commissions, which is fully documented and illustrated in Humphrey Repton in Hertfordshire, was for a modern pleasure ground at Ashridge, then a private house owned by the Duke of Bridgewater in 1813. In recent years, 2 of the 15 gardens Repton designed for this commission, the Rose Garden and the Flower Garden, have been restored. Repton more often designed the grounds of local gentry or businessmen than the great estates of aristocrats. He was highly sensitive to the social aspirations of the moderately wealthy and their particular concern to dominate, or at least appear to dominate, the countryside around them, something he described as appropriation. He was also more aware than Brown had been of the close links between the size, role, and architectural style of a residence, its particular character, and the design of its grounds. Tom explains that these concerns need to be viewed in the context of wider contemporary changes in society and economy, especially the growing social importance and influence in the late 18th century of the local gentry and the rising numbers and increasing wealth of merchants and financiers keen to build villas with parks, often without a significant estate attached, within easy reach of the major cities. Such changes were particularly important in Hertfordshire, and especially in the south of the county, where many wealthy London businessmen bought small manors or even farmhouses and converted them into fashionable residences. Sometimes these clients did not see eye to eye with Repton about the extent of work needed, causing him to write on one occasion that if profit was his employer's only motivation, the flower garden might as well be sown with potatoes and cabbages. Good taste, he wrote loftily, can only be acquired by leisure and observation. It is not therefore to be expected in men whose time is fully employed in the more important acquirement of wealth and fame. Repton certainly worked for many such clients in Hertfordshire, impatient to have their estates improved in the latest style. In the quest for evidence for the Repton sites in the county, there have been unforgettable moments. After weeks of painstaking searches, a Hertfordshire Garden Trust researcher believed she had tracked down a missing red book to a small London museum. She made an appointment with the curator. A small red book was on the table, she remembers. It was undoubtedly a Repton red book, bound in red Moroccan leather. When I looked inside, I had a wonderful surprise. The book had not been looked at for decades or even longer, and the sketches were as bright as the day they were drawn. This book, Humphrey Repton in Hertfordshire, Documents and Landscapes, is available now from Hertfordshire University Press. And this article is accompanied by some pictures of the sketches and paintings that he would have included in his red books.
Hello, I'm Jill Burridge, and with me in the studio today is Tom Hammond, Principal Conductor of the St Albans Symphony Orchestra and also Artistic Director of the Hearts Festival of Music, which is an annual celebration of classical music centred around Hertford. And as you'll gather in a moment when we start talking, Tom also has many other musical working hats to wear in the course of his career. So, Tom, this is an interview really which is part of a series that we're running focusing on your job and what it entails. So let's start with the festival, the Hertfordshire Festival of Music. It was founded in 2016. How did it actually come about?
It was a happy accident, at least I think it's a happy accident, in that I had recently taken over the Hertford Symphony Orchestra, who needed a new conductor. And we were talking about how we could develop the work of that orchestra, who self-promote 6 concerts a year, which is an awful lot of work, and play to a very high standard. And I thought, you know, we could go and play for someone else. You know, we could take our orchestra to somebody else's music festival. And having started to learn about the amazing amount of music that happens in this county, I thought there would just be lots and lots of opportunity and lots of classical music festivals. So I was detailed at the end of that meeting to go away and research classical music festivals in Hertfordshire. Now, the thing is, there are some fantastic festivals. Of course, there's the Organ Festival here in St Albans, and there are lots and lots of chamber music series, but there was no dedicated sort of, as it were, intense, because this year we're up to nearly 2 weeks, classical music festival going on in the county, which I just couldn't quite believe. And then I was chatting to my long-term friend and musical collaborator, James Francis Brown, who's a composer, and we accidentally decided to start a music festival. And that was towards the end of 2015 that conversation happened, and 2016 is when it all started.
And it's really grown because you started with just a weekend and now you're at 2 weeks.
Nearly 2 weeks, yeah.
Mm. This is in the middle of June, I should sort of say, isn't it? It starts sort of...
That's right. So it's the 13th to the 23rd this year, to be precise. But what we wanted to do, actually, was to be giving concerts around midsummer, because I think that sometimes going to concerts can be a bit of a pain for our audiences. You're traveling, it might be in the dark. When do you eat? You're going to eat before, you're going to eat when you get home, and all these sorts of things. And we thought, how nice if, you know, when you left a concert, none of our concerts are particularly long, actually. We've tried to think about that experience for the audience, and it's probably still going to be light actually when you leave. And also, Hartford's a very attractive town. People tend not to know it. It gets a little bit swallowed up, dare I say, because St Albans is a pretty big centre of population. But it's an interesting place, an historic place with lots of interesting buildings, actually. A fascinating link to the Knights Templar, which I won't expand on here, but it's something I'm researching, actually. Lots of nice independent shops and restaurants, same as St Albans has, of course. So, yeah, we've decided to pitch it around midsummer.
And you've managed to attract some really big star names. You've got people like Dame Emma Kirkby and Tamsin Little and Stephen Huff and Stephen Isserlis.
Yeah, that's right. So we really wanted to not muck about. We wanted to get some of the best people we possibly could, not least because it helps drag attention towards the festival. Also because these are all fabulous musicians and also very nice people to collaborate with.
Mm, absolutely. So what are they playing, some of them?
Well, this year, Stephen Isserlis is involved in a number of events. He is performing the Haydn Cello Concerto, the first of the two. That's quite an early work by Haydn, and Stephen decided that he wanted to help set a bit of a theme for the festival this year, which is early works by great composers and contrast with some of the last utterances. So in the chamber music concert he's giving on the 15th of June, on the Saturday that he's with us, it ends with Fauré's string quartet, which was his last work. So hopefully that's quite an interesting thing for the audience to sort of compare and contrast very early pieces and with those very late works. Stephen Isserlis is a huge fan, actually, of Fauré. And I think for those who know Fauré through the Requiem, they'll find all the things that they like there. But it's interesting to hear how his musical mind had stretched and developed.
It sounds wonderful. Let's just go back to the Haydn. And I think you mentioned that there is actually a local connection for Haydn.
Yes, there is. We didn't know about this until the festival had been sort of born in our heads. But it turns out that Haydn spent a significant amount of time. The year was 1791. It was his first visit to the UK. He'd not that long been released from his shackles as an employee of a prince in a not particularly nice place. He moaned about it quite a lot. And a London concert promoter called Salomon had been desperate to get him here. And we have to try and put our heads into 1791 England, where a composer like that was a rock star. So this was front page news that finally the great Haydn that everyone had heard of and played pieces of his at home was actually coming to the UK. And he enjoyed an incredibly successful year, giving sold out concerts and being wined and dined in London. But he was finding London, actually Soho, where he was staying at the time, was pretty noisy, and he said he couldn't really get on with writing music. So he'd made a friendship with a man called Nathaniel Brazzi, I think that's how we pronounce his surname, no one seems to know, who said, well, actually, I've got a place in the countryside, why don't you come and have a bit of a break? So he spent 6 weeks living in a place called Roxford House, which is just outside Hartingfordbury. If people don't know where that is, that's
very close to Hartford.
Very close to Hartford, yeah. And 6 weeks is quite a long time if you're a composer like Haydn, who wrote a lot of music very quickly. And he wrote back to his friends in Vienna saying how much he was enjoying it, how pretty it was, that he was spending his mornings walking the woods learning his English grammar. And also he makes a very interesting, for people like me, reference to working very hard. And we're still researching what we think he might have actually written whilst he was staying in this house. It's possible that some of his most famous later symphonies were written right there.
More to find out.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
So I think we can hear just a taster of that Haydn cello concerto. And your professional career, did you start out thinking you were going to be a musician?
It's all been an accident all the way along, because usually, you know, a lot of musicians come from families where music was part of family life, and mum or dad, you know, played or sang or whatever. And actually, my family really didn't have any great interest in classical music at all. And how it all came about really was that in my parents' record collection, there were a couple of sort of nominal classical LPs, I think to possibly try and slightly impress someone coming around for a dinner party or something. There was Chopin's Greatest Hits, there was Beethoven's Greatest Hits, and there was Sibelius's Greatest Hits. And apparently when I was about 8 or 9, I started playing Sibelius's Greatest Hits on some kind of loop, and at which point my parents clearly could see that I was destined to be a bit strange, and that was true. I didn't live in an area where there was a huge amount of music going on, to be frank, and so I just fell in love with it kind of all by myself. And to cut a very long story short, I'd ended up playing the trombone because a neighbour had heard from my mum that I was very interested in music. And he said, oh, you know, I've got a trombone I used to play when I was younger in my garage. Would you like to try it? And that was how I ended up playing that instrument. Eventually, I got a place to study at the Royal Academy of Music in London, where I did an undergraduate course as a trombone player, and then spent most of my 20s and early 30s as a professional trombonist doing all sorts of things, from symphony orchestras to playing at Shakespeare's Globe to doing stuff in the West End. You have to be diverse to make a living in music, frankly. But conducting had always been something that I'd had an interest in, and that was odd because I was pretty shy as a kid and no one had encouraged me to do it. I don't know where it all came from, frankly. But when I was 16, I promoted a concert in my local church for charity. And a few people said they thought I'd got some kind of ability. I kept doing conducting projects throughout the time I was principally a trombone player. And then in my mid-30s, there was an opportunity came up at Trinity Laban Conservatoire, which is in Greenwich. And the late, great Sir Charles Mackerras had basically bestowed this position for a fellowship in conducting. And I was very fortunate in being chosen to do that. And that was the point at which I decided I just was going to take a leap and swapped from playing to conducting, as my former trombone colleagues refer to it as I crossed to the dark side.
It's funny, the sort of brass section of the orchestra has quite a reputation, doesn't it?
Yes, I would say it does. I think they're all a gentler breed these days, actually.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
So how hard is it really to sustain a career in professional music?
It's incredibly hard, and it is getting harder, unfortunately. There will always be a space for the sort of top 1-ish% of performers, instrumentalists, who've got talent in bucket loads, and places like the London Symphony Orchestra or the Royal Opera House will need those sorts of level of musicians. But the rest of us, mere mortals, I think it's a question of music isn't what you do, it's who you are. And I sort of feel like I've had no choice. I can't think of what else I'd get out of bed to do. So somehow you have to try and make it work, and diversifying your career, working very hard, accepting that you're probably never going to be especially financially secure, all of those things. But I think if you're the sort of person, and I think a lot of my colleagues would say this is the case for them, that there is no real choice. It's just something that you are.
It's a calling, basically, isn't
yeah,
it?
As yeah, what without that's wishing where your to sound too pretentious. Lie. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Because you do have, as I said at the very beginning, you have a number of hats. You've worked with the Hertford Symphony Orchestra, as you mentioned, the Essex Symphony Orchestra. You've also worked in Yorkshire. So you have to be prepared to go wherever there's work.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, that's the case when I was playing, and it's similarly the case for conducting. So I've been lucky. I mean, I've travelled to some fantastic places, both playing and conducting around the world. A project that's especially close to my heart, actually, is with the amazing young musicians in Palestine, which came completely out of the blue. Was recommended to go and help coach a course with the Palestine Youth Orchestra. And although I'd performed in Israel some years before that, I hadn't visited the West Bank on that trip. So I went to this place that, you know, we hear about in such negative light in the news, and went with all sorts of fears and expectations of what I would find. And one of the things I didn't think I would find was classical music being done to an incredibly high level by teenagers. And that's a relationship that's now been ongoing for, I think, 7 or 8 years. And just a few weeks ago, I was in Dubai conducting a concert with an orchestra formed of musicians from the West Bank, and the standards that they achieve in music are phenomenal, actually. And it's such a positive thing in a place where, frankly, we're only ever going to really hear negative news about. But I discovered so much about history through doing that. Met some amazing people, had some amazing experiences, and that's one of the great things about music.
It is. Well, let's come on to the St Albans Symphony Orchestra. Presumably you had to cope with a lot of competition for that job, did you?
Yes. Well, whenever orchestras like St Albans Symphony advertise for a new conductor, you will quite easily have 3 figures worth of applications, because there are a lot of people out there wanting to do it and not that many ensembles for conductors to conduct. So it's a competitive process, but I luckily managed to fool them, and have been there now for, I think this must be coming to my 4th season actually, with the orchestra.
And do you choose the repertoire, what they're going to play at every concert?
It's part of a process. So we try to balance the things that the members of the orchestra would like to play with what we hope will attract a good audience. And it's a long process, actually, and we have to filter all sorts of things. But we're trying to do 2 things, I suppose, which is to present concerts where I know the musicians on stage are really excited about what they're doing, and that's very important, and make sure that we also put pieces of music in the programme that are familiar enough so that we do get people to come along, not least on New Year's Day, which is a fabulous tradition of giving a New Year's Day concert in St Albans Abbey, where we have, I don't know how many hundreds, but it always looks...
You're always packed out,
absolutely packed out. Mm. And it's a real thrill, although it's slightly trashes New Year's Eve for me.
Yes. These days. So the concert that's coming up with the St Albans Symphony Orchestra, the very popular element is Grieg that night, isn't it?
That's right. So we've got Grieg's Piano Concerto. Now, that for me is one of those pieces that I don't care how many times I hear it or how many times I'm lucky enough to accompany it as a conductor. I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's got so many elements of excitement, fabulous tunes. It's a virtuosic thing for pianists to be able to play. It doesn't go on too long. It's just a cracking piece of music.
And it's instantly recognisable from bar one, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And also in that concert, you've chosen to play some Nielsen.
I was introduced to his music by my old head of English, weirdly, when I was at school. And I was knocked back by how fresh it was. And something in the energy of this music is quite something. And it really grabbed me. When I then looked into him as a man, as a composer, I discovered that, a little bit like me, he didn't come from a wealthy family. He had made music literally as a child. He discovered that the piles of logs behind his little shack that this family lived in made different pitches because some were bigger and some were smaller. And he got excited by music through that and listening to birdsong. He basically lived a life of rural poverty. He was herding goats till he was 15, and then he went into the Danish army as a trombone player.
So there was another
connection. Yeah. And then he went on to write music, and because he'd not had a formal training at the beginning, what you hear in Niels is individual, but it's also so fresh because it's just coming straight out of his imagination, no filter. We're going to perform his fourth symphony, which has a subtitle of The Inextinguishable. And what that means is that human life and spirit is inextinguishable despite challenges. And this was written just after the end of the First World War.
My word, I mean, those drums are amazing.
Yes, so we have to employ, very rarely you get to do this, two sets of timpani. It's a hugely theatrical moment, and that's really showing the kind of peak of conflict, essentially. Mm. And the question is, will the orchestra be able to win through?
I get the impression that your career, your job, you've got hardly a moment to take breath.
It can be quite hectic, and one remedy to that that's been great for me actually was we rescued a dog from a rescue centre in Radlett, and the 2 hours a day I try to walk my little dog Patch, they are the kind of breaks from it all. Although I then find myself walking around the park singing whatever I'm going to be rehearsing that evening as well. But it's all consuming, and as I said before, it's your life, it's your existence if you're into music in this way.
You told us about one of the most moving experiences in your career when you went to play in the West Bank. Mm. I gather that you also tried to teach James Corden how to conduct.
Good research. Yeah, that was hilarious. I don't get a chance to watch much television, so I rocked up to a recording studio, and I remember the lady was doing a bit of makeup, and she said, "Oh, do you watch the show?" The show being a kind of comedy quiz show on Sky. I don't have Sky TV, so I had no idea. And it's called A League of Their Own. And I said, no, I don't watch it. I said, do many people watch this show? And she said, oh, yeah, about 5 million. At which point I realised this was going to be quite a public thing. But it was all good fun. So, yeah, I tried to teach James how to conduct the beginning of Beethoven 5. And we also had comedy opera singing as part of it. It was brilliant laugh.
Was he any good?
No, he was absolutely dreadful at conducting, which is weird because he's actually a very good musician. He can sing and play, but for some reason couldn't quite translate that to the waving his arms in the air part of it.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom Hammond, for talking to me today.
Thank you.
The United Kingdom will be taking part in the European parliamentary elections on Thursday, the 23rd of May. Voting will take place between 7 a.m. and 10 p.m. at thousands of polling stations and polling places, and importantly, that voting process, just like with any other election, must be fully accessible to a blind or partially sighted person who's eligible to vote, and you needed to have registered to vote by May the 7th. We spoke to Richard Holmes, UK Parliamentary and Public Affairs Manager at RNIB, about the voting process, and we asked Richard to briefly outline how things should work on the day at the polling place or station when a vision impaired person walks in to vote. And we first asked whether you need to take any form of identification with you when voting.
There is no requirement to take ID to be able to vote. Indeed, we don't need to take our polling cards with us either, although that does help make things easier to find our names, but we don't actually have to take those with us either.
So you turn up at the table, as usual, a table in the polling place or polling station, and you say, I want to vote. You then can expect what to happen?
That's correct. You turn up at the table and you hand over your card or say your name, and then you can expect to be directed towards on the wall or given a copy of a large print list of the candidates, most relevantly with the number attached to them, because that then fits into the actual practicalities of casting the vote itself, and they can provide further assistance with going into the polling booth if that's what's wanted too. But crucially, there is a template that fits over the voting slip itself, which means that having seen the list, a person can then tick the number that they want to tick either themselves or ask for assistance for someone in a polling station to do that on their behalf, whether that's a staff member or a member of their family.
So you can only vote on the standard print voting paper, can't you, that everyone else is using?
That's a very important point. Yes, there isn't provision to have large print ballot papers or papers in Braille, for example, because there's concern around the lack of independence, because easier to trace who that person would be who would have cast that vote. So the voting slip itself is a standard size, but the template fits over it to facilitate making voting easier, rather than having to simply say you want to vote for someone and getting someone else to vote for you, which is clearly not an acceptable process at all.
No, because the process is there for people to be able to vote in secret, in private. It is a very private thing, how one votes, and that must be maintained, assuming the person wants it to be.
Exactly, yes. Like so many things, it's about choice, about options. If a person is happy to share that information with a member of the staff in the polling station within the privacy of the polling booth or a member of their family, then that's obviously their right. However, if they wish to vote more independently and more under their control, then they should ask for the template, which should be available in every polling station and should be understood by the polling staff as to how to fit that onto the ballot paper.
I guess there are quiet times and there are busier times on any day when votes are being cast. I mean, there are sometimes some bottleneck times, and other times you can go along and it's really quiet. But whenever one goes along, how important is it to be able to take your time and have explained to you properly what is going on? Because for sighted people, it's so much easier. You've got a big list, you can see the list, you can see what you are choosing from. So how important is it to make the point, I'm doing this at my own pace?
I think that's extremely important, and I think if anyone has the flexibility to go along at less busy times, I think that that would be an extremely wise thing to do for precisely the reasons that you've outlined. Staff there would feel less under pressure because there wouldn't be queues of people, and therefore the blind person or partial person themselves would also feel less under pressure because things are being explained more coherently and they can feel like there's more support and more understanding available. So perhaps not voting, for example, between, say, 6 and 8pm, for example, when people tend to come home after work and vote. If a person has that flexibility, maybe vote a bit earlier, would be a wise decision to take.
Over the years, RNIB has always published information about accessible voting, how to go about it. What's your feeling about whether more blind and partially sighted people are being able to realise what is, after all, a fundamental democratic right, being able to vote? Is the whole process getting easier, better, more accessible?
After the 2017 general election, we produced a report called Turned Out, which gave a lot of information based on many people's experiences, which did suggest that more people are aware of not just what's available, but also, therefore, how to ask for what's available as well, which then increases awareness and understanding amongst polling staff as to how they can support. So I think that information and awareness is definitely improving both amongst visually impaired people and amongst those working at polling stations. So that's clearly a positive. What I would say is that there's still more work to be done, because whilst the voting template certainly helps, it still isn't entirely an independent process. So it's better than nothing, but there's still more work to be done as to how how we make voting fully independent and fully down to the individual themselves, rather than perhaps this situation that's an improvement but isn't by any means a final solution.
And for information about the candidates and party manifestos in accessible formats, you should ask the political parties themselves individually, and they are duty-bound to provide that for you. And should you want to know anything else about the location of polling stations or polling places in your area, it will be on your polling card, but that's only issued in print. Or you want to ask about anything else to do with voting, inquiries should be directed to the Election Office or Electoral Services Office of your local authority, wherever you live in the United Kingdom. And once again, although you probably don't need it repeating, the UK will be taking part in the European parliamentary elections on Thursday, the 23rd of May, with voting taking place between 7 a.m. and 10 p.m.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Hilary, Caroline, Sarah and Karen. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme, but that's all from me, Bill Redway, in May 2019. We close with Emma by Will McNichol and Luke Selby. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye. Thank you.